survive it. The voices ended abruptly and left one crystalline alto singing, "And many more." The crowd of creatures parted suddenly, and a girl stepped out of their ranks. She paused for a moment for dramatic effect and to give everyone time to admire her. She'd changed her hair again. Now it was a kind of extra-wide mohawk, long except for where it had been shaved completely away from the sides of her head, where the cut could show off the tips of her gently tapering ears. It was still colored in all glacial shades of blue and green and deep violet, and hung down over much of one side of her face, allowing her to borrow enough of Veronica Lake's vibe to give her wide, wide eyes a little extra hint of cheerily wicked mystery. She was tallish for a girl, maybe 5'10", and built with that perfect balance of lean and lush proportions that some girls are lucky enough to have for maybe a year, the kind of look that gets girls that age in trouble with men who should be old enough to know better. And she was naked, gloriously, disconcertingly naked, and just as fresh and vibrant and unspoiled-looking as she'd been the first time I'd met her, most of 10 years before. Only, you know, she'd been less naked then. Man, was I ever noticing that part. "Here's the birthday boy," Maeve said in a sing-song voice, flinging both arms up. She started toward me in a slow and slightly exaggerated walk. Technically, she wasn't entirely naked. She had silver piercings at the tips of her breasts, beneath her lip, in her navel, and probably elsewhere. I didn't let myself look quite that close. Her flawless, pale skin was also spangled with gemstones. I don't know how they'd been attached, but they clung to her and sent little flashes of color glittering around the cavern when she moved. They were concentrated most densely around her, well, she'd been, vajazzled. She came slinking over to me in the silence, her green eyes framed in a quasi-mask of gemstones and some kind of henna inking, and she absolutely smoldered with sex. Not that she'd never been suggestive before, but this was taking things to a whole new level. "Look at you," she said, walking around me and eyeing me slowly and thoroughly. "Rumors of your death have been greatly exaggerated, it would seem." "Hi, Maeve," I said. "You know, I almost wore the same outfit. Gosh, would our faces have been red." The Winter Lady, Mab's successor and understudy, completed the circle and stopped in front of me, just oozing pure animal attraction.
"It is a birthday. I wore a birthday suit."
She took a deep breath, mostly for effect.
"I hope you approve."
Hell yes, I approved. Or at least everything south of my upper lip did. Way more than it should have, really. She wasn't using some kind of magic on me. I had gone on alert to such a possibility the second I'd seen her. It must have been all the rest and the exercise and the good diet, most of which I'd successfully avoided back in the real world. It had resulted in a robust and healthy yet perfectly normal libido. Perfectly normal. It wasn't me changing. Whatever Mab had done to me that had healed a broken spine, made me able to run at vampire speed, and given me the kind of reflexes that were capable of keeping up with the attack of a furious Malk, hadn't changed me on some fundamental level. Everything was perfectly healthy and normal here, in denial land. Maeve's eyes met mine, and she gave me a slow, slow smile. And, as when Mab had been near, I felt my whole body thrum in response to her. To her presence, her proximity, to her everything. That smile contained something within it, something conveyed to me in a flashing instant. Maeve, as she would look in ecstasy beneath me, looking up at me with that lovely face, mindless with sensation. And with that image came 100 or 1,000 others, each of them a single captured moment, the kind of moments that are the only one to survive a frenzied dream, frozen and layered atop one another, each of them a promise, a prediction, and every one of them aimed right at the most base, most primitive parts of my brain. It wasn't limited to visual imagery. Each layer of the flash had its own round of sensual memory, every one of them only partial but intense. Touch, taste, scent, sound, and vision. Dozens and dozens of dreams and fantasies compressed into that one instant of dark inspiration. I've had sex that didn't feel as good as Maeve's smile. "You hear me," came Maeve's thoughts, along with the images. "You hear me now, because we are together now, just as you are with Mab. I felt you, you know, when you joined yourself to us. And I want to feel more. You are my knight as well, Dresden. Let me welcome you. Come to me. Come with me. Walk by starlight, and let me show you secret delights." It took me a couple of seconds to remember that I was still standing there in the icy hall, still wearing my clothes, still standing most of an arm's length away from Maeve. When I spoke, it was through clenched teeth. "Sorry. Already got a date for tonight, Maeve." She dropped her head back and laughed. "Bring her," she said, her eyes both dancing and wild. Her eyes shifted to Sarissa, who took a short breath and went stiff beside me. "She's gorgeous, and I would love to get to know her better."
"Imagine the possibilities, my knight."
Another multisensory slideshow hit my head, and every single image was something that I should have known better than to find intriguing, but that I could not bring myself to entirely ignore. Only this time, Sarissa was included.
"I can show you pleasures you have never dreamed could be. Bring your lovely companion. I will give you her and many, many more besides."
Again, my head lit up with lunatic pleasure maybes, dizzying, electrifying, and I felt as if I were about to start tearing my way out of my clothes. And just for a second, I considered it. I'm not really proud of that fact, but it's not like I'm beyond temptation either. I'm just as stupid as the next guy, and for just a second, I thought about seeing what was behind door number one. I knew it would be foolish, and fun, yeah, but mostly foolish. I knew that I'd be an idiot to go along, and yet, one day, something is going to kill me. It might be some monster. It might be my own foolishness. It might be what gets most everyone in the end. Simple, implacable time. Although I wasn't betting on that one. I'd been closer to the idea of my own death lately, having been dead, or at least mostly dead, for a good while. And I wasn't any more comfortable with the idea. I didn't have any more desire to go out in an ugly, painful way than I did before. And if you gotta go, there are probably worse ways to do it than in a blaze of sybaritic glory. Damn, Maeve had a great pitch. Everyone selling something to a sucker does. The entire hall had gone completely silent, except for my own harsh breathing, and I suddenly became aware of the tension in the air. Every being there was waiting, and I suddenly realized that this was the second murder attempt of the evening. Maeve was trying to destroy me. "You ever make Lloyd that offer?" I asked. Maeve tilted her head, staring at me, her smile suddenly frozen. "Cat got your tongue?" I asked in a louder voice. I put scorn into it. "Did you not hear the question?" The frozen smile became something subarctic.
"What did you say to me?"
"I said no, you psychopathic hose beast," I answered, spitting out the words with every ounce of contempt I could muster up. "I saw how you treated Lloyd Slate, I saw how you treated the changelings of your court. I know what to expect from you, you arrogant, spoiled, self-involved, petty, cruel little queen bee twit. Maeve's expression changed, though not in any kind of focused way. She looked startled. Sarissa gave me a shocked look. Then she glanced around, as if hunting for a foxhole, or bomb shelter, or perhaps some kind of armored vehicle to throw herself into. "You sent your last handmaiden to murder my friends on their wedding day, Maeve," I continued in a voice loud enough to be heard by the entire hall. "Did you think I'd forgotten that? Or was it just too small and unimportant a fact for you to keep it from dribbling out of your alleged brain? Do you think I'm too stupid to understand that you set up this surprise party in the hopes that you'd startle me into spilling blood at court, Darth Barbie? You tried to murder me just now, Maeve, and you think a little psychic porn is going to make me forget it? I can't decide if you're insane or just that stupid." Maeve stared at me, with her mouth dropping wide open. "Now hear this," I said. "You're cute, doll. You're gorgeous. You inspire supernatural levels of wood. And so what? You're damaged goods. So turn around and move your naked little ass away from me before I do it for you." For a long moment, there was dead silence. And then Maeve's face twisted up in fury. The seductive beauty of her features vanished, replaced by an animal's rage. Her eyes blazed with pure fury, and the temperature in the air dropped suddenly, painfully, enough to cause icy frost crystals to start forming on the ice. The freaking ice iced over. Maeve glared at me with naked hatred in her two big eyes, and then gave me a small bow of her head and a little smile.
"It would appear we yet have a life to celebrate," she hissed. "Music!"
From somewhere in the room, the symphony began playing again. The silent gang circle ring of bedtime story villainy broke up with fluid grace, and seconds later you would have thought you were at any kind of extremely wild, extremely posh costume party. Maeve's eyes glittered, and she spun once, displaying herself to me with a mocking little flick of her hair, and then vanished into the crowd. I turned to Sarissa and found her staring at me with wide eyes.
"You turned her down?"
"Uh-huh."
"No one does that. Not here."
"Whatever," I said.
"You don't understand. The insult you've just given her is...
Sarissa shook her head and said, with masterful understatement,
"You just earned a little payback," in her mind.
"That was going to happen sooner or later," I said. "What bugs me is her response."
"Music?" Sarissa asked.
"Yeah," I said. "And in a minute there might be dancing. Can't be good."
"It could be worse," she said. She took a deep breath and settled her arm in mine again. "You won the first round."
"I only survived it."
"Here, that is winning."
"So, if we win the rest of the night, we'll be making a good start." I looked around us and said, "Come on."
"Where are we going?"
"Somewhere that isn't the middle of the floor," I said. "Somewhere I can put my back to a wall, and hopefully somewhere with snacks. I'm starving." Chapter 5. I'm never really comfortable at parties. Maybe I'm just not the partying type. Even when they aren't full of lunatic elves, hulking monsters, and psychotic fairy queens, parties are kind of tough for me. I think it's because I'm never sure of what to do with myself. I mean, there are drinks, but I don't like being drunk, and I'm pretty sure I don't get any more charming when I do get that way. More amusing, tops, and that isn't always in a good way. There's music, but I never really learned to dance to anything that involved an electric guitar. There are people to talk to, and maybe girls to flirt with, but once you put all the stupid things I do aside, I'm really not all that interesting. I like reading, staying home, going on walks with my dog. It's like I'm already a retiree. Who wants to hear about that? Especially when I would have to scream it over the music to which no one dances. So I'm there, but not drinking, listening to music, but not dancing, and trying to have conversations with near strangers about anything other than my own stupid life, and they generally seem to have the same goals I do. Leads to a lot of awkward pauses, and then I start wondering why I showed up in the first place. Hell's bells. The kind of party with monsters is actually easier for me. I mean, at least I have a pretty good idea of what to do when I'm at one of those. The food table was set up over the replica of the trap door that used to lead into my sub-basement. It was open in the giant model, which meant that there was a gaping hole in the icy floor, and if you slipped at the wrong moment, you'd wind up falling down into Stygian darkness. I wondered whether the drop was to scale. The table was loaded down with party food of every description, but apart from the sheer variety, it didn't look like anything but regular old food. I inhaled through my nose and felt absolutely certain about that. This was mortal chow, not the fabled ambrosia of fairy. "Thank God," Sarissa said, picking up a pair of plates. "Food. I was afraid they'd have nothing but those flour trifles again."
"Wait," I said. "Are we sure this is food?"
"You can't smell it?" she asked. "I can always tell. Local cuisine is not exactly subtle. Practically the first thing I learned here was how to tell the difference." She started loading up both plates, mostly things I probably would have picked anyway. Well, she had basically been my dietitian for nearly 3 months. She'd know by now what I liked and didn't. Weird. Would it be like that if I ever had, like, a wife or something? Whoa. Where the hell did that thought come from? All the recent, if entirely bent, domesticity? My heart did a weird little rabbit-like maneuver, beating way too fast for a few seconds. Hell's bells, had I just had a panic attack? At the very notion of calling some woman my wife? Though, now that I thought about it, I wasn't sure I had ever used that word in connection with myself and somebody else at the same time. Not explicitly, anyway. I shook my head and filed the thought away to be examined later, when I didn't have a great big target drawn on my back. I let Sarissa pick us some food while I kept an eye out for someone or anything suspicious. After about 20 seconds of that, I decided that it was an impossibility, and dialed it back to watching for anyone who rushed us with a knife, screaming. I kept my defensive spells right on the tip of my mind, so to speak, and ready to erupt into reality at an instant's notice. I spotted a good, quiet corner for us to stand in, over by the giant mantel above the giant fireplace. I took the plates from Sarissa, and we started that way. A form that I recognized emerged from the crowd in our path, and I found myself smiling. The creature that came limping over to me wasn't much more than 5 feet tall and leaned on a heavy, gnarled walking staff. He wore a hooded robe of undyed linen, belted with a length of soft-looking rope. 3 folded strips of purple cloth were tucked into the belt, the formal stoles of senior members of the White Council of Wizards, taken after they fell to him in separate duels. Oh, and he was a goat. Well, a very human-looking goat, anyway. He had the same long face as a goat, and curling ram's horns on his head. His eyes were golden, his beard long and white, and he looked pleased. "Eldest Gruff," I said, smiling.
"Sir Knight,"
he replied, his basso a pleasant rumble. We exchanged small bows, which also seemed to please him.
"Please do thou accept my best wishes on this day of your birth."
"Gladly," I said. "How do they rope you into showing up to this freak show?" He sighed.
"Obligation."
"Word." I nodded to Sarissa. "May I introduce Sarissa? She's been helping me recover from an injury. Sarissa, this is..."
Lord Gruff, she said, giving him a courtesy that somehow seemed natural. How lovely to meet you again, sir.
It is pleasant to see thee, child, said Eldest Gruff. Thou dost seem to thrive despite the climate.
That might be a generous assessment, Sarissa replied.
I prefer to think of it as a hopeful one, the Gruff said. I see thou hast attached thyself to the new knight.
No, I said quickly. No, she hasn't. There's been no attaching. She's been doctoring me.
Sarissa arched an eyebrow at me and then said to the Gruff,
It was Mab's price.
Ah, the Gruff said. A heavy burden obligation canst be, for winter and summer alike.
He glanced aside at me.
Does he know of thine?
It hasn't come up, Sarissa said.
Ah, Eldest Gruff said, raising his hands. He had weird nails. They were hoofy. I will then follow the course of silence.
Sarissa inclined her head.
Thank you.
Of course.
Two more figures approached us, both of them over 7 feet tall. I'm not used to being the shortest person in any given conversation, or even the shorter person. I can change light bulbs without stretching. I can put the star on a Christmas tree without standing on tiptoe. I'm like the bumble, but with way better teeth, and I didn't like feeling loomed over.
Which probably should tell me about the kind of effect I might be having on other people, sort of generally speaking, and especially when I gave attitude to power figures who were shorter than me, but that kind of crystallized moment of enlightenment probably wouldn't be helpful in winning the evening. The first was depressingly familiar. He was dressed in hunter's leathers, all gray and green and brown. There was a sword with a hilt made from some sort of antler at his side. It was the first time I'd seen him wearing something other than a helmet. He had shaggy, grizzled, light brown hair that fell to his shoulders. His features were asymmetrical, but, though not handsome, contained a certain roguish charm, and his eyes were an unsettling shade of gold-green. I didn't know his name, but he was the Earl King. One of the beings of faery powerful enough to lead the wild hunt, and he was the reigning ruler of the goblins. Not like the big, ugly dimwit in The Hobbit. Real goblins are like mutant Terminator serial killer psycho ninjas. Think Hannibal Lecter meets Jackie Chan. Oh, and I'd insulted him once by trapping him in a magic circle. Fairies, large and small, hate that action.
Gruff, said the Earl King, tilting his head.
Eldest Gruff made a small bow in reply.
Lord Hearn. Know you these children?
Aye,
said Eldest Gruff. He began making polite introductions. I studied the man standing beside the Earl King while he did. He was a sharp contrast. The Earl King was huge, but there was something about him that suggested agility and grace. It was like looking at a tiger. Sure, it might be standing there all calm and relaxed at the moment, but you knew that at any second it could surge with speed and terrible purpose, and that it wouldn't give you any warning before it came at you. This man wasn't a tiger. He was a bear. His shoulders were so broadly proportioned that he made Hearn look positively slender by comparison. His forearms were nearly the size of his biceps, and he had the kind of thick neck that you see only in powerlifters and professional thugs. There were scars all over his hands and more on his face. All of them faded away to ancient white lines, like those you see on some lifelong bikers. He wore a coat of mail of some kind. A creature of faery couldn't abide the touch of iron, so it had to be made from something else. Over the mail he wore a long, open coat of scarlet, trimmed in white fur. It was held in with a wide black leather belt. He had such a barrel of a chest that even a modest bit of stomach was a considerable mass on his huge frame. His gloves were made of black leather, trimmed with more white fur, and they were tucked through the belt, right next to the very plain and functional hilt of an unadorned broadsword. His hair was short, white, and shining clean, and his white beard fell over his chest like the white breaker of a wave. His eyes were clean winter sky blue. I lost track of what Eldis Gruff was saying because my mouth was falling open. The second man noticed my expression and let out a low, rumbling chuckle. It wasn't one of those ironic snickers. It was a rolling, full-throated sound of amusement, and it made his stomach shake like, dare I say it, like a bowl full of jelly. "And this," Eldest Gruff said, "is Mab's new knight." I said, "sorry, hi," I stuck my hand out, "Harry Dresden." His hand engulfed mine as he continued to chortle. His fingers could have crushed my bones. "I know who you are, Dresden," he rumbled. "Call me Kringle." Wow. Seriously? 'Cause, wow.
"Oh my God, that's adorable," Sarissa said, smiling. "You are such a fanboy, Dresden."
"Yeah, I hadn't really expected this kind of thing." Kringle let out another rumbling laugh. It absolutely filled the air around him. "Surely you knew that I made my home amongst the beings of Faerie. Did you think I would be a vassal of summer, lad?" "Honestly," I asked, "I haven't ever really stopped to think it through."
"Few do," he said. "How does your new line of work suit you?"
"Doesn't," I said.
"Then why did you agree to it?"
"Seemed like the right thing to do at the time." Kringle smiled at me.
"Ah, I didn't much care for your predecessor."
"Ditto," I said. "So do you come to all of these?"
"It's customary," Kringle replied. "I get to visit folk I rarely see elsewhere." He nodded toward the Earl King and Eldest Gruff. "We take a few moments to catch up."
"And hunt," the Earl King said, showing sharp-looking teeth when he smiled.
"And hunt," Kringle said. He eyed Eldest Gruff. "Would you care to accompany us this year?"
Gruff somehow managed to smile.
"You always ask. You always say no."
Eldest Gruff shrugged and said nothing. "Wait," I said to Kringle. "You're going hunting?" I pointed at the Earl King. "With him? You?" Kringle let out another guffaw, and I swear to God, rested his hands on his belly while he did it.
"Why wouldn't I?"
"Dude," I said. "Dude, you're freaking Santa Claus."
"Not until after Halloween," he said. "Enough is enough. I'm drawing a line."
"Ha," I said, "but I'm kinda not joking here." He grunted and the smile faded from his features.
"Lad, let me tell you something here and now. None of us is what we once were. Everyone has a history. Everyone comes from somewhere. Each moves toward a destination, and in a lifetime as long as mine, a road can run far and take strange windings. Something I judge you know something about."
I frowned. "Meaning?" He gestured at himself.
"This became the tale with which you are familiar only in fairly recent times. There are wizards enough alive today who knew of no such person when they were children awaiting the winter holiday."
I nodded thoughtfully. "You became something different." He gave me a wink of his eye. "So what were you before?" Kringle smiled, apparently content to say nothing. I turned to Sarissa, asking, "You seem to know these guys, mostly. What?" She wasn't there. I looked around the immediate area, but didn't see her. I moved my eyes back to Kringle and the Earl King. The two of them looked at me calmly, without expression. I darted a glance to Eldest Gruff, whose long, floppy right ear twitched once. I glanced to my left, following the motion, and spotted Sarissa being led onto the dance floor underneath the replica of my original Star Wars poster.
The poster was the size of a skyscraper mural now, the dance floor beneath it the size of a parking lot. For the most part, the Shi were dancing, all fantastic grace and whirling color, with the occasional glitter of jewel-like feline eyes sparkling as they turned and swayed. A young male Shi was leading her by the wrist, and from the set of her shoulders she was in pain. You couldn't have guessed it from her expression. The young Shi wore a black leather jacket and a Cincinnati ball cap, but I didn't get a look at his face.
"A fresh challenge, it would seem," the Earl King murmured.
"Yeah," I said. "Gentlemen, if you would excuse me."
"You know Mab's law at court, aye?" Kringle asked. "You know the price of breaking it?"
"Yep."
"What do you mean to do, lad?"
"Seems that what we have here is a failure to communicate," I said. "Think I'll go open up a dialogue."
Chapter 6. Moving on to a dance floor full of Shi is like dropping acid. Partly it's because they're just so damned pretty. The Shi maidens there were all in Maeve's league in terms of sheer physical attractiveness, and some of them were just about as barely dressed as she was, only in what must have been the latest trends in the Chicago club scene for the fashionably provocative. And yeah, the boys were pretty too, and tarting it up just as much as the girls, but they weren't nearly as much of a distraction to me. Partly, it's because of their grace. The Shi aren't human, even though they look like close relatives. When you see an Olympic gymnast or ice skater or a professional dancer performing a routine, you can't help but be impressed with the sheer, casual grace with which they move, as if their bodies are lighter than air. The clumsiest of the Shi operate at about that same level, and the exceptional leave the mortals eating dust behind them. It's hard to describe because it's hard for the brain to process. There's no frame of reference for what I saw. The motion, the balance, the power, the effortless subtlety. It was like suddenly discovering an entirely new sense with an enormous amount of input. I kept seeing things that made my brain scream at me to stop and watch so that it could catalog and process them properly. And partly, it's because of their magic. The Shi use magic the way the rest of us breathe, instinctively and without thinking about it. I'd fought them before, and their power was largely invoked through simple gestures, as if the spells had been hardwired into their motor reflexes. For them, movement was magic, and at no time so much as when they danced. Their power didn't come after me specifically. It was more like I had plunged into it, as if it were a pool of water occupying the same space as the dance floor. It subsumed my mind almost at once, and it was all I could do to grit my teeth and hang on. Ribbons of colored light flared in the air around the dancing Shi. Their feet struck the floor, and their hands struck upon bodies, their own or otherwise, adding rippling layers of syncopated rhythm to the music. Gasps and cries joined with the beat and the melody, primal and fierce, echoing and challenging one another from all quarters as if they'd practiced it. They hadn't. It was just what they were. Sound and rhythm struck from either side, thrumming against my ears, disorienting me. Light danced and fluttered through the spectrum in subtle, seductive patterns. Bodies twisted and strained in inhuman artistry, their very grace an assault upon my reason. Part of me wanted to just stand there and drink it in, gawking like some ugly, clumsy behemoth among the Shi. Plenty of mortals have been lulled into tearful rapture by such dances, and generally speaking, it hadn't ended real well for them. I put up every mental defense I could, reaching for that core of cold, clear power that had been within me since the night I'd murdered my predecessor with Medea's bronze dagger. I hadn't even realized what was happening to me at the time, since other things had been on my mind, but I now realized that it had restored my shattered body and given me strength and speed and endurance at the very limits of human ability, and maybe past them.
I felt it only when I sought it out, but apparently my instinctive need to survive had been enough to tap into it back when I'd set out to rescue my daughter from the late Red Court of Vampires. Now it poured into my mind like an ice-cold breeze and withered away the bedazzlement the she's dance had wrought on my thoughts. I started forward through the throng, and for a few feet I tried to skip and slip and duck my way through the moving crowd without hitting anyone. Then I realized that even with whatever I had gained from becoming the Winter Knight, I was still hopelessly dull-witted and slow-footed when compared to the she. So I just started walking and left it up to them to get out of the way. It kind of fit my mood better anyway. They did it, too. None of them were obvious about it, and some of them came within a fraction of an inch of striking me with whirling limbs, but none of them did. The she are tall, generally speaking, but I'm NBA tall, and I could see over the crowd. I spotted the red ball cap and the flash of Sarissa's wide eyes and went after them. I caught up to them near the back wall of the cavernous chamber. The she who had grabbed Sarissa now stood behind her, one of his arms wound around her neck and the other around her waist, holding her back against his chest. Her eyes were wide now. I could see deep red flushing on the skin of her wrist, where bruises were already starting to form in the shape of the she's fingers. I found myself clenching my hands into fists and growling deep in my throat. Without any evident forethought to it, the dance floor for 10 feet all around any of the three of us became clear of moving bodies. The she had made room for the confrontation. Jewel-like eyes glittered and watched intermittently while the dance continued.
"Sir Knight," said the she, holding Sarissa.
He had straight black hair beneath the cap, and cheekbones so high that they needed to wear oxygen tanks. He was smiling, and there was something particularly vulpine in it. His canines were just a little too large, a little too sharp.
"What a pleasure it is to speak with you."
"You aren't going to think so in a minute," I said. "Let her go." He leaned in closer to her and inhaled through his nose.
"Odd," he said. "I don't smell you on her. You haven't claimed her as your own."
"She's not yours either," I said. "Let her go. Don't make me say it again."
"She's just a mortal," he said, smiling. "A mortal of no station here in Arctis Tor, at court. This place is not meant for mortals. Her body, her mind, and her life are all forfeit, should we decide to take them."
"We just decided to let her go." I began walking toward him. Something feverish came into his eyes, and I could suddenly see every bone and tendon in his hand tight against his skin. His nails seemed a little too long, a little too heavy, and a little too sharp to be normal. Sarissa tried to speak, but only made a choking sound and went silent.
"You keep coming," the she said, "and I'll keep squeezing. This game is terribly interesting. I wonder how hard I'll have to squeeze to crush her windpipe."
I stopped, because I knew the answer to his question. Not very hard. It's only a little more pressure than you need to crush an empty beer can. It's sort of scary how easy it is to kill someone once you know how to get it done.
"What about Mab's Law?" I said.
"I'll not shed a drop of her blood," he replied smoothly. "When I cut off her air or break her neck, she'll simply cease, which is a waste, but the law is the law."
And I got a sudden sinking feeling that the she in front of me, in his black leather jacket and his red cap, knew how to get it done.
"You're not a Cincinnati fan, are you?"
"Ah," the she said, smiling. "You see, Sarissa, he's worked it out. It took a while, but he got there."
"You're a red cap," I said.
"Not a red cap," he said, snapping annoyance in his voice. "The red cap, little knight."
The red cap was one of those figures I had hoped was a story. According to what I knew of legend, he got his name by greeting travelers in a friendly fashion and then murdering them horribly. Once that was done, he would dye his cap freshly scarlet by dipping it in their cooling blood. Odds seemed reasonable that he was a badass. Legend was about as reliable as every other rumor mill on the planet, but looking at the guy, I got the impression that he would smile and have an erection the whole time he murdered Sarissa, or me. He certainly expected me to react with fear and caution. Which just goes to show you that no matter how old something is, centuries don't necessarily make it all that bright. "The big, bad red cap," I drawled. "And when you were picking a red cap for tonight to emblemize your power and skill, you went with Cincinnati over Philly? Or Boston? Seriously?" The red cap apparently didn't know what to make of that. He just stared at me, trying to decide whether he'd been insulted or not. "Man, you she are a crowd of posers. Did you know that? You try to do and say the things you think will push our buttons, but you just don't get it, do you? Have you ever been to a ball game? I caught one with Gwyn Ap Nuth a few years back. Decent guy. Maybe you've heard of him." "Do you think your allies frighten me, wizard?" the red cap demanded. "I think you're an opportunist," I said. "A what?" "You heard me. You jump people traveling alone, people who don't have a chance in hell of defending themselves against you. Especially not when you make nice and put them off their guard first." I gave him a toothy smile. "I'm not off my guard, Red. And I'm not someone who doesn't have a chance against you." "Touch me and I will kill her," he snarled, giving Sarissa a little jerk by way of demonstration. I looked at Sarissa and hoped that she could read deeper than the surface. "That's bad, but there's not much I can do about it if you decide to kill her now," I said. "Of course, after you do that, I don't really like your chances, Red. If she dies, you'll join her." "You wouldn't break Mab's law," he sneered. "You're right," I said. "So I figure I'll just open a way back to the mortal world, drag you through it, and after that, well, I've always been partial to fire." Evidently that line of possibility had not occurred to the red cap.
"What?"
"I know it's not thematically in tune with my new job and all, but I find it effective. Build a man a fire and he's warm for a day," I said. "But set a man on fire, and he's warm for the rest of his life. Tao of Pratchett. I live by it. You wanted to face me down in front of everyone, get props for tweaking my nose on my first night here? Well, congratulations, Red. You're the man." The red cap's eyes narrowed, gleaming bright, and his fox-like smile widened. "You think I'm afraid of you?" "The last time somebody swiped my date to a party, it got a little messy," I said in a very mild voice. "Ask the Red Court about it."
"Oh, wait."
The red cap actually laughed at that, and it was hurtful. Literally. My ears rang painfully at the sharpness of the sound.
"It is nothing to me how many cockroaches or vampires you have ended, mortal. I am she."
"Whatever," I said. "Killed some of them, too."
"Yes,"
the red cap said, and there was an ugly, hungry heat in his tone.
"The Lady of Summer. I was in that battle, mortal. I saw her blood flow."
I nodded and said, "And what makes you think I won't do it again?" The red cap jerked his chin a little to one side and said,
"They do."
I froze.
"Damn it, Harry," I chided myself. "You're dealing with fairies. There's always a scam with fairies. There's always a sucker punch on the way.
I'd gotten too forward-focused. The Red Cap hadn't been a challenger. He was the bait. As if on cue, the wild dancing turned to stillness. The music died. All motion in the chamber, as far as I could tell, ceased entirely. And suddenly I stood in a small glade within a forest of lean, wickedly beautiful figures and weirdly sparkling eyes. Two figures emerged from that forest, shambling out from the crowd of she, one on either side of me, maybe 15 feet away. The first, on my right, was a huge figure, shuffling forward with its form doubled over beneath a tattered gray cloak that could have covered a small truck. Its legs took strides that were 2 or 3 times as long as mine, and when it came to a halt, its long arms spread out to either side of it and rested on the floor. Beneath its hood I could make out a flat, broad head, as stark as a skull, and colored red and glistening. Its arms ended in hands with only 3 fingers, but they were proportionally too thick and a couple of feet long. They, too, were red and glistening, as if something had been built on a bone framework with flesh and muscle added on over it. But then whoever had made it had forgotten to put the skin on. It dripped little patters of ichor onto the floor and stared at me with very wide, very white eyes that contained only tiny pinpoints of black. I recognized the thing. It was a raw head. A creature that assembled itself out of the discarded bones and flesh of slaughtered hogs and cattle. Then they started eating whatever they could catch, usually starting with pets, then working their way up to school children, and finally hunting down adults. If you caught them early, you should shut them down hard. But no one caught this one. As I watched, it rose slowly up to its full height of well over 10 feet. Its jaws had come from more than a couple of different creatures, and they spread open in a slow, wide gape into a mouth as wide as a water slide tunnel. More liquid pattered down out of the raw head's jaws onto the floor, and its breath rasped in and out in a slow, enormous wheeze. On the left, the second figure drew back its hood. It was maybe only 8 feet tall, and mostly human-looking, except for the thick coat of yellow-white fur that covered it. It was layered in so much muscle that it could be seen even through its pelt, and its eyes were burning, bloodshot orbs shining out from beneath a cavernous brow ridge. It was the Winter Court's version of an ogre. It was a great deal stronger than it looked, and if it wanted to, it could pick me up and drive my head into one of the icy walls, then hammer my spine in like a piton. "I've been waiting to see that expression on his face all night," the Red Cap said to Sarissa. "Isn't it priceless? What's going to happen next? I'm so interested." Taking on a little friendly training and a grumpy Malk was one thing, but going up against 3 of the nastier creatures in Faerie all at once was probably a losing proposition. Maybe I could survive it if I was fast and good and a little bit lucky. But Sarissa wouldn't. I had only one real chance— instant and overwhelming aggression. If I could knock one of these bozos out of the fight before it even started, that changed the odds from overwhelming to merely daunting. It meant that there might be a chance of saving the girl. Of course, it also meant that I would break Mab's law. I'd bragged about opening a way, and if push came to shove, I probably could, but not before the raw head and the ogre closed in on me. Just then there was a sound. A shriek, a blast of cruel trumpets that sounded as if whoever blew them was being beaten with a salted lash. It took me a second to realize that no instruments were playing. Instead, high up on the constructed replica of my favorite chair, at my left shoulder, crystals were thrusting themselves up out of the ice and screaming as the ice changed form. They rose into a half-dome of spikes and frozen blades, and shuddered as the center of the new outgrowth shifted again. Wisps of arctic blue and green and purple buzzed and whirled within those sharp spikes, sending out a wild coruscation of colored light. The aurora was mesmerizing and blinding at the same time, and little disco balls hoped that they could grow up to be half as brilliant one day. Mab stepped out of the solid ice as if passing through a gauzy curtain. She was in formal wear, a robe of opalescent white, belted with joined crystals of ice. A tall crown of more ice rose from her brow, and her white hair spilled down around her like snow atop a mountain. She was distant and cold, as pure and lovely and merciless as moonlit snow. She stood for a moment, staring out at the cavern. Then she sat, the motion slow and regal, and the ice within the spiked dome reshaped itself into a seat beneath her. She settled onto it, and the ice screamed again, shrieking out a second tortured fanfare. Every head in the cavern turned to her. The she all around me knelt at once, including the Red Cap and his buddies. All over the chamber, other beings of the Winter Court did the same, and suddenly only a very few people were standing upright. I was one of them. So were the Earl King, Kringle, and Eldest Gruff, though each of them stood with his head bowed in acknowledgement of Winter's ruler. I took my cue from them, but kept my eyes open. I spotted Maeve, standing only 40 or 50 feet away, on an icy deck that had been formed to look like a paperback that had fallen from one of my bookshelves. Maeve was in a perfect position to see the conflict between the Red Cap crew and me, and she hadn't bowed either. She was sipping something ice blue from a champagne flute and ignoring her mother's presence entirely, but I could feel her malice burning toward me even though she wasn't looking directly at me. Mab studied me and my playmates for a solid minute, saying nothing, and in that silence you could hear the fluid dripping from the rawhead's various bits onto the icy floor. Maeve turned to her mother and sipped at her blue champagne. She said nothing, and her features were entirely smooth and relaxed, but you could just smell the way she was smirking on the inside. And only then did I really get it. Maeve's first attempt to get me to start a fight at court had been a distraction then. She'd wanted me to focus on her, to unnerve me with her high-voltage psychic sex moves. That way I wouldn't be thinking clearly enough to avoid it when the Red Cap sprang his surprise. Mab stared down at the Winter Lady for another silent minute. Then she smiled and bowed her head very slightly toward her daughter, the gesture one of acknowledgement. "Well played," Mab murmured. She didn't raise her voice. She didn't have to. The ice rang with it. Her eyes shifted to me, and though she was too far away for me to make out any details, I somehow knew exactly what the expression on her face meant. I had allowed myself to be drawn into this mess. I would have to be the one to get me out of it. I was on my own. Mab turned her gaze back to the rest of the room.
"On this day of celebration of our newest knight's birth, we give you greetings, one and all, you lords and ladies of Winter. Welcome again to our home. We can see that the celebrations are already well underway." She settled back on her throne and placed one finger against her lips, as though she were fascinated with the scene before her. "We pray you, do not let our entrance further disrupt them." She lifted a languid hand. "It is our desire that you continue the festivities."
"Oh, fun." I turned back to face the Red Cap, keeping his wingman in my peripheral vision, and tried to think of something, anything, that would get both me and Sarissa out of this mess. The rawhead gathered itself into a crouch again, clearly ready to pounce. Its mismatched set of claws and talons gouged at the floor in anticipation. The ogre flexed its hands open and closed once. It sounded like a popcorn popper. The Red Cap already had his feet underneath him again, dragging Sarissa effortlessly up with him. And I was wearing a tux.
Hell's bells. Clearly, if I wanted us to survive the evening, I had to step up my game. Mab's voice came out as a throaty purr.
Music. Let us see a dance.
Chapter 7. The odds here were long. Way long. All three deadly fairies stood ready to move, and no matter which of them I took on first, Sarissa's outlook wasn't good. The music began, low and quiet, with a slowly, slowly rising presence. I needed some kind of edge, a game-changer. In fact, a game-changer was exactly what I needed. Fairies are always underhanded and tricksy, true, and I'd overlooked that a few moments before. But there's something else about fairies that runs absolutely bone deep. They love to play games.
Why don't we make this interesting? I said out loud. I trust you wouldn't object to making a bit of a game of our dispute.
Oh, the room got intense then, as maybe 1,000 throats all inhaled at the same time. I could practically feel the air grow closer as all of those beings leaned very slightly toward me, their suddenly sharpened interest filling the cavern. The tempo of the music changed with it as well, now all suspended strings and muted percussion. I felt a surge of emotion run through me, one that I knew was not my own. It was too pure, too primal, and it made my body do that thrumming thing again. Mab's approval was fierce.
"But, wizard," said the redcap, "we're already playing a game. One cannot change the rules simply because one is losing."
"But one can change the stakes," I replied. "What if you could get more out of it?"
The redcap narrowed his eyes.
"What more could you have to lose than your life?"
I gave him what I hoped was a patronizing smile and then said,
"Wait, why am I talking to the tool instead of the person holding it?"
I turned my back on the red cap, gulped, and faced Maeve.
"I'm offering you a prize, Winter Lady. Are you willing to hear me out?"
Maeve's eyes sparkled more brightly than the jewels on her midriff. She came to the edge of the platform and stood watching me.
"If he wins," I said, jerking my head back at the red cap, "I'll go with you, willingly."
Maeve tilted her head.
"And if you win?"
"Sarissa goes free. You leave, peacefully."
Maeve thrust out her lower lip.
"Peacefully? That's hardly ever any fun."
She lifted a hand and idly toyed with her hair.
"As I see it, I already have a prize, mortal. I get to see Mother watch the steam rise from at least one fresh corpse here in her own court."
"You're absolutely right, Maeve," I said. "And you've got me in a pickle, and it was cleverly done." I winked at her. "But what fun is the game you've already won? Why settle for so ephemeral a prize, however worthy, when you could take Mab's knight from her in front of all of Winter?"
That one sank home. I could feel the sudden urge of ambitious lust that went racing through the Winter Lady, and the seething hatred that went along with a swift glance toward distant Mab on her throne. Maeve's mouth curled up in an expression that bore as much resemblance to a smile as a shark does to a dolphin. She snapped her fingers, the sound almost as loud as a small-caliber gunshot, and Tu-Shi hurried to her side, escorting a dazed-looking, athletic young man. Maeve didn't wait for him. She simply sat. The Shi shoved the young man to his hands and knees, and Maeve's slight weight settled across his broad back.
"I'll give you this much, Mother," she said, without looking toward Mab. "You do pick the most interesting mortals to serve you."
Mab's smirk said more than any words could have. Otherwise, she neither moved nor spoke.
"My lady,"
began the red cap behind me.
"Hush,"
Maeve said absently.
I want to see what happens. What did you have in mind, wizard?
In answer, I reached up and with a couple of quick tugs undid my tux's tie. It wasn't one of those pre-assembled ties. It was made out of a single band of pure silk.